BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
It looked at first like an attack just on hospitals in the UK, but it's now becoming clear that this malicious software has run riot around the world.
Malicious hackers have been using one particular weapon for years. Worms.
In case you haven't heard the term Code Red, it's a worm that's infected computers around the world, and it's supposed to do its most damage tonight at 8 p.m.
They infect one computer, then spread across entire networks.
Ficker is a virus that runs in stealth mode on your computer, and it spies on everything you do.
More cyber chaos spreading in the form of these titles. This is a great new game, even Mother's Day gifts. They're no gifts. Their computer.
But where did it all begin?
The Defense Department, universities, and research centers are still recovering tonight from a computer virus that brought a nationwide network to a standstill.
The suspect, somewhere, a dark genius.
My personal speculation is that this is somebody who is trying to warn people.
Why do you think the Morris worm should be considered a key moment in hacker history?
Well, it's not the first worm. It's not the first malware. But it was the first one to really capture the attention both of the public that administered computer systems and the general public at large. So in some senses, it is a start of the malware epidemic because it gained so much publicity and awareness.
I'm Gabriella Coleman, a professor of anthropology at Harvard. And this is The Hackers, a series that delves into the hidden histories of hacking and uncovers how it shaped the world as we know it. In this episode, we're looking at the granddaddy of modern malware, the Morris worm. At times, there's a confusion between what is a worm and what is a virus. A virus is a piece of code that adds itself to another program, but it needs that host to run it in order to activate. A worm is a program that can self-propagate and spread from machine to machine. Once unleashed, it can copy itself ad infinitum. One of the first people to analyze the Morris worm, then known simply as the Internet worm, was Eugene Spafford.
I am a professor at Purdue University in Indiana in the United States.
This incident happened in the 1980s, an age of internet innocence, but also a time when very few people were actually on the internet. To be online, you basically had to be in a university or a government agency.
The people who were connected together, we generally were all scientists, researchers, and we had some knowledge of computing security, had some concerns about it, but not major concerns because we all effectively came from a similar kind of workplace, similar kind of background, and assumed that others would take the use of the systems as seriously as we did.
Then, on the evening of November 2nd, 1988, the worm slithered its way onto the network. The next day, unaware of the infestation, Gene sat down to dial into his university network.
And for listeners, dial-in meant using a telephone, acoustic coupler to connect to a computer system. So early in the morning, probably it was about 7:30, as I was having my coffee, I tried to dial in to read the mail that had possibly come in overnight and discovered I couldn't get on. So I dialed into a second system that I had access to and got on and looked at the diagnostic information on my primary system and discovered that the load of the machine, the number of processes running, was 20 times higher than normal. And that explained why the response was non-existent when I tried to connect. So I rebooted the system, then disconnected and logged in directly. And after really only a couple minutes, the performance started degrading again. It's getting slower and slower. So I went through the same process of disconnecting and logging in through the alternate connection and discovered that the load average was up again and now knew that something was wrong.
The worm could get onto machines in several ways, exploiting vulnerabilities in the software, but also human error. If you had a password weak enough to be cracked, the worm would use that to access your computer. As a test, it would plant a small foothold program like a scout. This scout would signal back to the server of origin and request a large package of software. that software was the main worm. It was meant to run undetected, but there were a couple of flaws.
It had some other software that didn't work quite correctly to reach back to another machine, to register itself. And there was a second flaw that was the reason that we all noticed it. The author of the software had realized that a vulnerable host, a victim, might be contacted by multiple remote instances of this software to try to establish itself on the victim, a reinfection, if you will, and had built in a signaling mechanism so that those second and third and fourth and so on attempts to reinfect would get a message that the system was infected and they would stop trying. But for some reason, had built in that, as I recall, one out of every seven of those attempts would succeed nonetheless. And as a result, in environments with well-connected machines, such as mine was, we had multiple instances of this program getting started and running. So at first one, and then two, three, four. And each one of those was scanning the network looking for victims, trying to break passwords, using a lot of CPU. And after enough of them got running on the local machine, it would basically become unusable, and in some cases might even crash.
Whoever designed the software had the worm probe machines to see if they'd already been infected. But this detection feature used so much processing power, it caused machines to freeze. That led people to notice the worm, and of course, they panicked.
I heard an interesting story from a friend of mine who worked for the Department of Defense and was actually on duty at the time that this occurred, and basically pulled the plug on the connection between the internet at large and the DoD portion of the network because they were worried about what this might be doing or what information it might be transmitting out.
It wasn't only governments and universities that were panicking. The as-yet-unknown creator of the worm was also frantically trying to warn people about what they had unleashed. Problem was, the worm was already so well-established, email was down. They couldn't contact anyone.
And how was it stopped?
When we analyzed it, we found that creating a directory or a file of a certain name in the temporary space on a machine meant that if the program tried to create itself on the machine, it would fail with an error because that space in the temporary area on the potential victim was already occupied and it couldn't use the space. So it would terminate. And so this became a kind of an inoculation, a vaccine, if you will.
That would protect computers that hadn't been infected. But for those machines already compromised by the worm, add the file, then turn it off and on again. Tried and true panacea of all computer repair. Also, get a better password, as true today as it was then. The worm had been exterminated, but now the FBI wanted to find whoever was responsible. Who was that dark genius at the heart of everything? Well, he was actually just a student named Robert Morris, who had, as we said, been trying to stop the worm. Think Mickey Mouse frantically trying to stop all those evil brooms. Eventually, he turned himself into the authorities and was arrested.
There was quite a bit of discussion in some of the online mailing lists at the time because Mr. Morris was well known to a community at Arbel Labs, which is a major research entity at the point, and the majority of people there seemed to be defensive of what he had done. And so there was a lot of back and forth in the community about he was doing people a favor by showing that there was a security vulnerability, and others who were saying, we didn't ask to be shown that, and particularly not to shut down our machines, and therefore it was something that was wrong. And so that discussion played out, and still, in some quarters, there can be debate if you get a couple people together to talk about it.
The worm had shaken the early internet community, but Morris had not written a deliberately destructive piece of software.
The damage that it caused was because of the coding error or the conceptual error that caused multiple instances to run on a single host and overwhelm it. A great deal of emphasis was placed on a number that came out of MIT where they said that 10% of their machines had been impacted, and by extrapolation, that meant about 6,000 machines out of the entire internet. 60,000 machines were on the internet at the time. But it's not clear that that was the case, because the composition of machines at MIT were unlike lots of other sites. So it was probably less than that 6,000 machines overall on the network were impacted. In retrospect, that damage was effectively negligible.
Nevertheless, Morris was prosecuted and in fact became the first person convicted under the CFAA, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. He was sentenced to 3 years probation, 400 hours of community service, and a fine of $10,050, plus the cost of his supervision. The question remains, why had he created the worm? To this day, we don't know. He never explained it. Maybe, like with a lot of hackers, it was just because he could. Since then, he's gone on to become a respected professor, and he was elected to the National Academy of Engineering, a reformed citizen. Do you think Morris's punishment was deserved?
It was extremely poor judgment to release untested code on other people's machines. It would be the kind of thing where, for instance, if somebody decided to set off fireworks in a flammable building, they didn't intend for the building to burn down, but it was malicious behavior in an environment and they didn't know what the consequences were going to be. So in that sense, I think what he did was wrong. I still do. I believe that the court, that the prosecutors and the judge also realized that he was contrite, that he hadn't intended damage, but in fact, he had done something wrong.
While Morris didn't seem to mean any harm, the worm fundamentally changed the early internet. The actual damage to computers might have been small, but the age of innocence was over. Not everyone who would have access to the network would respect it. The worm led to the creation of CERT, the Computer Emergency Response Team at Carnegie Mellon. Gene Spafford also went on to create the Phage mailing list to coordinate security experts. But the worm also inspired many malicious actors. Black hat hackers often use worms in ransom attacks. One worm, WannaCry, brought the NHS to a standstill a few years ago. Why do you think worms are still so effective today?
There's a variety of reasons, and one of those is that we still have many institutions that don't take securing their systems seriously. WannaCry in particular took advantage of systems that hadn't been patched, hadn't had updates made to the software. My understanding of some of the problems at NHS is that the software was running on machines connected to medical imaging and medical treatment devices, and applying the patches would require a very lengthy and difficult certification process to make sure that the patch software didn't interfere with the medical equipment. But it comes back around to having a willingness to invest and a willingness to hire trained personnel whose advice is considered in configuring and protecting systems. And I think that's going to go on for a while. That's one reason why ransomware continues to be a problem. Not the only one, but it continues to be one of the root causes.
The original floppy disk containing the Morris worm is exhibited at the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California, sealed up in a soldered plastic box as if it could somehow still be infectious. It's a reminder of how vulnerable we are, especially now the internet is a daily presence in our lives. Hackers don't always have malicious intent. Sometimes they're just satisfying curiosity. But for those who do mean harm, a worm can still be a powerful weapon if we don't protect ourselves against it.